This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. It's Meera Siva. So the decisions that may have an environmental impact, among other things, are increasingly being made outside the national sovereign sphere. It is now increasingly recognized that many problems have an international dimension. For an example, impact of the tsunami, impact of the environment on human health and to the economy from the haze. What regulates this international dimension? Professor Gurdial Singh, Center of Excellence for Biodiversity Law from University of Malaya, joins me to discuss how we can regulate biosafety here in Malaysia. Welcome, Professor. How are you today?
Thank you. Good.
Professor, how did you get into this? I mean, how did you grow an interest for, you know, environmental biodiversity law?
Well, I was involved in several public interest issues that affect humankind, citizens, affect human health, affect the environment. And I was doing several cases as a lawyer at that time. And then so naturally, I went to these areas where new technologies were emerging which could have adverse impact on human health and the environment. Mm-hmm. And so it was a natural, almost seamless transition to look at these issues which were attracting international attention and a clamor for regulation.
Are there many lawyers like you around who are interested in biodiversity law?
I think there is. I've developed a course at the University of Malaya on biodiversity law and biosafety law. So we can say that there is a corpus of group, lawyers, many of them from Attorney General's chambers, from private practice, from academia, who are interested in this subject and have taken this subject. I think this is the fifth year we have running it at a postgraduate level.
Fantastic. Have we taken these laws seriously in the country?
Oh, yes. We have, in fact, enacted a Biosafety Act. The clamor for Biosafety Act arose, the impetus for it, rather, arose as a result of an enactment of an international regulation to dealing with GMOs, genetically modified organisms and products mm-hmm. derived from those organisms at the international level. And the idea was, the clamor for this was propelled by developing countries led by Malaysia. And we were involved in those negotiations as well.
Right. And when you talk about biosafety, does that just mean GMO? I mean, there's far more to biosafety than GMO.
Well, actually, it deals with modern biotechnology. Modern biotechnology is a technology which allows for the introduction of genes into a species where the gene never existed before and will not exist in nature. Mm-hmm. For example, you take a fish gene and put it into a tomato because you want the fish that swims in very cold waters. It has a certain preservative quality about it. So one of the first experiments was to put this gene in tomatoes because tomatoes rot very easily mm-hmm. and cannot last. The object was to make this tomato last. Now, you'll never find a fish gene transposed into a plant, for example.
Yeah.
So this technology started because they first could identify genes, and then they had a technique to cut that gene and then to paste it and then be able to shoot this gene into a different species with the expectation, or the hope at least, that that new gene will be taken up by that host organism.
Where does someone like you come in terms of implementing the law?
Lawyers come in because one of the aspects that deals with this is a new technology. It has its downside. It could have potential adverse effects with regard to the environment or with regard to human health. And therefore, it requires regulation. And regulation means lawyers have to promulgate the regulations in accordance with the policy of the government or international obligations. So this is where lawyers play a key role to first understand the policy and the objectives of the policy, to understand our obligations in international law with regard to any treaty that has been established with regard to this, and then to formulate the law, and finally to be able to implement or advise on the implementation of this law.
Biosafety, biodiversity, both words used very loosely, interchangeably. Is there a difference?
Well, biodiversity, bio is from the word biological. Mm-hmm. So there is biological diversity throughout the world. There are a variety of species that exist. There is a diversity of species, and this diversity is what gives the world its character. And this diversity is what really feeds, heals, and clothes the world, because traditional knowledge uses in relation to that exists in nature, the diversity that exists in nature, is what propels pharmaceutical companies, for example, to seek out certain plants or genes within plants and to create pharmaceutical drugs, for example, out of those. So the biological diversity is what provides, it's the pharmacopoeia for mankind. And the leads are provided by traditional users, traditional knowledge users.
How do you regulate biodiversity?
Most important thing is that you must therefore preserve this biological diversity, because it is a source of incredible stuff that helps humankind. Mm-hmm. Of course, human development starts to cut down forests in which biodiversity rests in a very large way. And the whole object of the world at one time was to arrest this erosion of diversity by human activity. So they then enacted an international treaty called the Convention on Biological Diversity, which had as its objectives to conserve, sustainably use, and provide benefits for those who are conserving and sustainably using and providing these resources.
How successful do you think this convention has been?
It has at least created a very significant awareness, as a result of which a large number of countries in the world have enacted laws to protect their biological diversity, for example, like India and so on. And one of the components of this, you know, if you want to preserve and sustainably use, you must make sure that you provide the right incentives for people to do that. Otherwise, nobody is going to do it. So there is a concept that developed out of this, which is called benefit sharing, when anyone accesses your resources. So there is a now put in place, under this convention, another treaty, which we participated in negotiating, which provides for benefits to be shared whenever you provide those resources to a third party, like drug companies, multinationals involved in agriculture and seed and so on.
Is Malaysia signatory to the convention and treaty?
Yes, in fact, it was one of the, with regard to the Convention on Biological Diversity, which was established in 1992, mm-hmm. we have been one of the early signatories to that treaty, and we are quite serious in enhancing our biological diversity to various policy measures, administrative measures. And then the other treaty that grew out of that, which was a move by developing countries to say, look, you know, we are the providers. We have the forests, for example. We are the providers of these genetic resources. But people are accessing those resources and not giving us the benefits. So this move by developing countries, which had a large amount of biological diversity within their geographical boundaries, they formed a group and then advocated very strongly, you know, lobbied very strongly for an international treaty to be established. Because, you see, what was happening was that these pharmaceutical companies, mainly from the north, for example, would come, rely on the indigenous traditional knowledge of people, and then use that lead, and then convert those into, do research and development, convert it into products, make a lot of money, and there was no return for developing countries which were nurturing, or for traditional indigenous people who were nurturing this biological diversity.
We could fall prey to that. I mean, we have a vast biological diversity in our rainforests, and, you know, we have so much to offer.
That's right. In fact, we are the largest rainforest in the world, mm-hmm. oldest rainforest in the world, 150 million years. In comparison, the Amazon is only 50 million years. So there is this huge wealth, natural wealth, that we have to anchor our next growth on and technology on. And that is why we are a magnet for a large number of companies. We have set up biotech. That's our next biotechnology. Modern biotechnology is our next wealth generation policy that has been devised by the government. So increasingly, biological diversity is going to be relied upon for purposes of the creation of new wealth through products.
Do you think we recognize this wealth as a nation?
We recognize this. I think our government is quite wary of this and has recognized it. The only problem may be implementing this in a manner that ensures that there is continued protection of this biological diversity. Because, you know, the pressure by foreign companies is quite great. So when we wanted to enact the Biosafety Act, for example, to ensure that those who introduced genetically modified organisms, that is, organisms that are created through this genetic engineering, this modern biotechnology, when we wanted to ensure that our biological diversity, for example, will not be destroyed by the introduction of these genetically modified seeds or plants into the environment, there was a great deal of opposition, primarily by corporations from the North, led by the United States of America. And the whole attempt was to scuttle the creation of this regulation called the Biosafety Act through various, lobbying mechanisms and so on and so forth. So the at various stages, I think authorities succumbed to that kind of lobbying for a period of time. But ultimately, I think good sense prevailed because we are a party to international conventions that require us to put in place biosafety measures. And so we have now a fairly decent, well-balanced Biosafety Act, which ensures that any genetically modified organism or product that is introduced into the country is subject to regulatory measures and advisory committees and so on and so forth.
An act is enforceable. Being signatory to a convention or treaty isn't. So does that mean there's still much to be done in terms of biodiversity laws in the country?
Well, we do not have a Biodiversity Act as such, but I think we have in place the lead agency is the Ministry of Natural Resources and Environment. And they play a very active role, both internationally and nationally, to promote biological diversity and to streamline biological diversity and make it part and parcel of our activities in relation to development projects and so on.
When we come back, we'll find out if Malaysia is well represented as far as international laws, when international laws are drafted. That's coming up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon and welcome back. It is The Bigger Picture and it's Mira Sivasudhi. We're discussing how we regulate biosafety in Malaysia with Professor Gurdiel Singh from the Centre of Excellence for Biodiversity Law, University Malaya. Now, Professor, what role does international cooperation play when it comes to biosafety measures? Because obviously, this is a very, you know, cross-border phenomenon. How do we manage that?
Yes, we have actually put in place the international community a protocol under the Biodiversity Convention called the Cartagena Protocol on Biosafety. And these signatories to this treaty, and there are a large number of signatories, are required to put in place regulatory measures to ensure that products that have a transboundary element, that means they are exported from one country to the other, are safe to the environment and to human health in the recipient country.
You were instrumental in this protocol, weren't you?
We participated to some extent in that protocol. And then subsequent to that, one of the main outstanding issues was on liability and redress. What happens if damage is caused by a GMO and sort of destroys a huge acreage of agricultural land and livelihoods? And for that, we participated very actively. I was involved in those negotiations as well. And we created a new treaty called, and it's named after Kuala Lumpur as well. It's called the Nagoya-Kuala Lumpur Protocol on Liability and Redress. So we did participate actively on that, and we have not signed onto that treaty yet, but we are putting in place our infrastructure with a view to signing the treaty.
Do you think Malaysia is well represented when these international laws are drafted?
Well, with regard to both the ABS law, we have, as I told you, access and benefit sharing of genetic resources. Mm-hmm. That treaty was 7 years in the making, as was this Kuala Lumpur protocol on liability and redress. We played a key role in these whole negotiations in leading developing countries, you know, who were mainly affected, who could be adversely affected. So we did play a lead role in the whole negotiating process, and treaties were finally concluded in October, November 2010.
The U.S. is usually not signatory to many of these conventions and treaties. Have they for the biosafety or biodiversity conventions and treaties?
Yeah, they're not parties.
Yeah.
But they play, in their characteristic style through various front countries, they play a very significant role in influencing the outcome. And because a lot of countries have trade with them, and it is one of the big modern biotechnology product, genetic GMO producer, it plays a very significant role in all of these processes. But you see, it stays aloof. It has a holier-than-thou attitude, you know, and adopts this, attitude that we can influence things, but we don't want to be subject to the regulatory processes involved in becoming a party.
Does that affect trade talks or how we implement laws in this country?
Yes and no. Well, strictly no, because we have our laws, we have our international obligations, and we fulfill them, right? And we have a basis to fulfill them and do it our way, uninfluenced by anyone, including the United States. But in practical terms, because they are one of our largest trading partners, and because they're quite brazen in attempting to come very frontally to lobby matters in their favor, they do influence our leaders in shaping our laws. And this is a bit of a downside for our democratic process. And let me explain. For example, we had the Biosafety Act. It was in its final draft stages. One of the provisions was on labeling. That means anyone who puts on the market, wants to put on the market, a product made out of a genetically modified organism must label the product to let people know, so that people have a choice.
Yep.
Besides other reasons. Now, the United States corporations came in very, very strongly to lobby against this labeling provision, because they said you would be prejudicing that product vis-a-vis other products. People will have, it will stigmatize the product. And they exerted a great deal of influence. And to our credit, the then minister, Dato' Azmi, was very strong in maintaining the fact that we will not deal with that. We will maintain our provision. Now, under the TPP, I understand that there is an attempt by the United States, because the United States plays a key role in this Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, mm-hmm. trade agreement. There seems to be an attempt to scuttle that provision as well, you see. We have not implemented it. It is in our law.
Yep.
And we have the Ministry of Health is in charge of this. They have amended the food regulations to say that there must be labeling. But yet we have deferred this, and the latest I heard is that it's deferred until June or July mm-hmm. of this year.
There have been many, many deferments, but what are your thoughts on the Trans-Pacific Partnership?
Well, it has to be transparent, and it must allow for wide feedback from the population and from ministries. And ministries must be open about this. There are a lot of issues which are cross-cutting. It's very difficult to just confine to say you look at this ministry looks at this text and does not look at any other text, because environment, for example, transcends the boundaries of ministries. And it is unrealistic to expect a good policy to be formulated in this truncated, myopic form where you only look at the text that is given to you, and maybe other text will be given to you if you ask for it, but without you knowing what that text actually means. Like this provision on labeling, for example. You know, this has gone through our consultative process and is part of our law. If you want to dismantle that law or roll it back, there must be widespread, wide scale, across the board, across ministries consultation. Now, this is not happening. I was involved in drafting the Biosafety Act. And even I, who has an abiding interest in this topic, and even in relation to something so specific as labeling, I'm just guessing at what the provisions are because of little leakages.
That's right.
Here and there. So this is the whole process, in my respectful view, is entirely flawed. When you have a democracy, when you have, you know, separation of powers, Parliament is going to decide ultimately on what people should or should not have, and yet you have a process that is going on that undermines this whole process, and it's being done externally. It's influenced by external processes. So I'm not against it as such, but you have to have an open discussion with our citizenry, because that is what ultimately democracy is about.
What are your main concerns now in the country as far as biosafety and biodiversity is concerned?
Main concerns with regard to biosafety is that we have to implement the law very carefully. And more importantly, we have to ensure that there is a need for that biosafety, for that product that is going to be introduced. The most classic example is this genetically modified mosquitoes that have been now are being experimented with. Now, the objective seems very laudable because dengue is a very serious problem.
Yes.
And so we want to deal with this problem. And so we appear to be enamored by a technological fix which can overcome this problem, which is, you know, these mosquitoes are genetically modified to be sterile so that when they mate with other mosquitoes, yeah, they will have progenies which will be sterile, and therefore these mosquitoes are not going to produce. So step by step, they will wither away, fade away, because they cannot produce offsprings. So I think the objective and the sort of a project proposal seems right. But there are a lot of downsides to this, because for a start, you know, mosquitoes only have a sort of flight of about 200 meters or something like that. There is a range. In other words, there's a finite distance that these mosquitoes can travel. So what do? You want to deal with dengue mosquitoes not just everywhere, every square meter of the country. So you're going to infest the whole country with these mosquitoes. For a start, it's going to be very expensive to deal with it in this particular way,
and it could turn on us. It could completely not work.
Yeah, it could completely not work, and we also do not know what the long-term consequences could well be. We do not know how it would affect other, because of it can cross species as well. You know, all these genetic modifications can cross species, can affect other species as well. So we are going into a terrain where we are required by law to be to adopt what they call a precautionary principle in dealing with environment and human health.
But to a large extent, do you think the law could also stifle science and development? How do you make sure that does not happen?
Not really, because science and development, research and development is usually in contained facilities. The Biosafety Act makes it very clear that if you are going to carry out research and development within confined space, you don't even have to apply for a permit. You just, under our law, all you got to do is to notify the relevant authorities, and you can proceed with your research and development. And then only later, if there is, you know, you have to also show what specific measures you're going to entail to ensure the safety. And then when there is a review subsequently of the specific measures and it is found wanting, then only the law steps in. So it is an open license to anyone who wants to do R&D within a contained facility. Contained facility is defined as a facility which will not have a direct impact or contact with the external environment. you're allowed to experiment with that. And also, if your product has been approved, your technology with regard to the production of a particular product, which is genetically modified, is approved. Then subsequent approvals are automatic if it involves the same transformation event and same person or same company that is involved. So this is the latitude that is, this is the balance that is struck. But if you're going to introduce something into the external environment, then there are the rigors of the safety requirements set in. And this is only fair because, you know, we are dealing with living organisms. And living organisms, unlike cars, for example, where you can recall a car which has a defective brake pad of some kind, because you can identify when it was created and when it was put on the market. But genetically modified organisms have a life of their own. They mutate. There are jumping genes. Anything can happen. You can't recall once released. The genie once out of the bottle can't be recalled.
Yeah.
And can have very... the incidence of anything happening might be very low, but the magnitude of the harm can be huge. And that classifies it as hazardous, which requires precautionary measures before it is released into the environment.
Professor, any other concerns besides the mosquito? What about viruses? You know, viruses travel, they mutate, you know. Do we have any control over that?
Yes, I mean, if you are going to genetically modify a virus to create a vaccine and so on and so forth, then also it is subject. So it is subject, that the act is very wide. If there is anything that you want to introduce into the environment which is modified, genetically modified, or a product derived from that, then you have to go through the process.
How do we, the layperson, how do we get involved in this process and to make sure that companies are kept in check now that we know that there is actually a Biosafety Act and the fact that, you know, we have been signatory to the conventions and treaties?
Yes, so public awareness is very critical because, you see, these genetically modified ingredients are being put in our food chain, for example, are being introduced into our environment. It affects everybody. For example, soya bean has been modified and approved for introduction into this country. Now, soya bean, lecithin, for example, you know, tofu, the base of it, is in something like 64 or so products. So if you look at ingredients, even ice cream for children has got lecithin, all right? And people could be allergic to material that is in products, including genetically modified. There's a need for the public to know and participate in this process because that is what they're going to put into their mouth and into their children's mouth. So the elementary aspect, you must be able to at least require the mandatory labeling of products of this kind. And then don't forget, we have in this country Hindus or vegetarians. Nowadays, you have things crossing species, right? What happens if you have a pork element introduced into a product?
There are pork elements in pharmaceutical products,
that's
isn't
right.
it?
Yeah. And then the whole debate, the whole debate on halal and haram emerges. We also have Hindus or vegetarians who don't want any animal products yep. introduced through this genetic modification. So the implications for society are very far-reaching. In fact, there's a fatwa that has been introduced with regard to GMOs not so long ago. And from what I understand, I stand corrected, but from what I understand, there are two important aspects of this. One is that, of course, if it involves ingredients which are non-halal, then it is forbidden under the fatwa. But as well, any product that's mudarat, they call it, which is adversely affects the environment, human health, right, has to be, is also something that the fatwa has talked about as being something that should not be introduced for use. Now, these are very important elements, but very few people know about it.
Yeah.
I talked to my Muslim friends, they do not know about this. And yet, these products are now quite pervasive, right? You have to look at web pages to find out what approvals are going on. So there has to be a public debate on these issues because this is very critical. As I say, it's going to affect human health and the environment.
Whose responsibility is it to disseminate this information?
It is the government's responsibility. In a sense, I suppose the government tries its government functionaries do try their best because I'm familiar with people who are in the biosafety board, so they try to hold meetings and kind of awareness programs, but it's just not sufficient because people are not aware. Surveys have been done which shows that people don't seem to be concerned about GMOs. They don't even know what it is. When you say GMO in the West, in Europe, for example, the constituents, citizenry is very alert. They don't want food, GMO food. There are whole supermarkets which thrive on the fact that they are GMO-free. And people, are impelled towards those kind of markets. But in our country, look at our mandatory labeling law. Until now, it's deferred, and no one has raised a hue and cry except for some NGOs whose views are sort of marginalized.
I wouldn't know if I'm buying a product that has GMO.
That's right, yes.
So do you see this labeling, mandatory labeling coming into force soon?
Well, they have now said it will come into force in June 2014. But accompanying that must also be an awareness program because, people, not everybody is interested to read a label.
Yes.
So it must be made clear why GMOs can, how and why they can impact on you, the fact that they are safe, the fact that they do not contain ingredients to which you or your child might be allergic. Now, these are important elements to introduce because, like I say, it affects everybody.
So for starters, where do we go to find out more? Is there a website or,
there
a
is
number
a website
that we can call?
By the, there is a biosafety clearinghouse that is being operated by under the Ministry of Natural Resources and Environment. So there is a biosafety board. There's a the whole department, biosafety department, which is fairly well manned. And I think they provide information on their webpage. And they've also actually got our center, we have assisted them in producing a user's guide. Mm-hmm. For those who are going to be affected directly, either as consumers or as producers or as people seeking approval, wanting to know the whole process, there is actually a user's guide to the Biosafety Act, which I think the Biosafety Department is expecting to launch at some time in the future. So I think these are attempts being made, but I think consumer groups, the Consumer Association of Penang, for example, has played a very active role.
They are very active.
On this issue.
Yeah.
So, in a sense, there is quite a bit of publicity and awareness raising, but it's just not reaching the ordinary consumer who goes into the market and places his hand on a product which could be genetically modified.
Professor, your message on regulating biosafety in Malaysia?
I think first is the public must take an abiding interest, must take a deep interest in this. And then we have to also look at the need for introducing some of these GMO products on the market. Is there a the fact that it's produced does not mean it must necessarily be approved for marketing. There must be a need established for that. There are so many products now that are being genetically modified, right? I just came back from Australia and you see them labeled. There they are labeled. And there are so many products that alert you to the fact that they're genetically modified. And so we should not willy-nilly introduce onto the market products. And the final point, of course, is we must apply the precautionary principle very clearly. Precautionary principle says, yes, you look at the science, but if the science is divided, right, as to the outcome, and science is divided on the outcome of a large number of these GMO products, then the better thing to do to protect your citizenry is to say no until such time as its safety is proved. I think this is the pathway we should adopt.
Thank you very much for joining me. Professor Gurdial Singh from the Centre of Excellence for Biodiversity Law, University of Malaya, on regulating biosafety in Malaysia on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.